Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We positively need to stock up on some more ice cream because it's hot out, and I've been rolling through this Taharka ice cream, the Honey Graham. I'm on my, like, fourth carton of this since, like, June 1st, and that's not, you know, that we're not eating the key lime pie or the roasted strawberry, because we are made here in Baltimore, award-winning ice cream, serving up social change, just like we're doing here in Baltimore Positive. Check out our friends at Taharka and make sure you're ordering that delicious ice cream. I'm trying to talk them into a macadamia nut pineapple one. I don't have to talk Evan Brand into opening a new Mexican restaurant because he's already doing that in Catonsville. El Guapo opening up a little later on in the month to go with State Fair. I have my favorites at State Fair, the chicken and waffles and the shrimp and grits and the delicious salads and the Brussels sprouts. I like all of that, but I'm really looking forward to seeing what Evan dreams up at El Guapo and some pupusas and some tacos and some margaritas. We'll be doing that in the 21228 very, very soon over there. And right here, right now, you can ship those Fadley's crab cakes anywhere in the world. If you're listening, you're already Baltimore Positive. You want to be more Baltimore Positive, get yourself some crab cakes and Fadley's. They deliver them to your door. You can stop down at Lexi in the Market. Now, everybody's lucky enough to live downtown and a few blocks away like I am, but you can ship them anywhere in the world. Last but never least, Mueller & Gary Realty still closing deals, taking great advantage of these low, low interest rates. I mean, so I'm hearing people getting like 2 3/4, 3%. It's crazy. So jump on it now. Find them at Mueller and Gary Realty. Don, I'm going to let you take the wheel here after I've done all the sponsorship stuff because you are the educator around here. I am the student. And I know this is an important time for everyone, for every parent, every teacher, every neighborhood, for where these children are in the future, for all of us in education. This is a weird time. You've been doing this your whole life. This is the strangest summer, right?
Yeah, I may be the educator around here, but during my career, we certainly never had a pandemic, never had to navigate what teachers are trying to navigate, what administrators are trying to figure out. Really, really complex times, obviously, in the United States of America, and can't think of anybody better to discuss what's going on than the president of MSEA, Cheryl Bowe. Cheryl, welcome back to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you for having me. Always excited to hear what's going on.
Well, Cheryl, I'll tell you, we threaten to invite everyone back. It's like, it's a radio thing. At the end, we're like, hey, we'll have you back on. We actually had you back on. So, I mean, I'm telling you, Don really likes you to bring you back right away. And we're on these key issues right now. For everyone in your constituency, I would say uncertainty is the word of the day. And we're human beings. We like certainty, right?
And educators especially. I mean, we do lesson plans, unit plans, year long. We want to know what's happening so that we can guide our students and communicate with parents. So to have so much uncertainty and so many people saying things on the news or we see what's happening, it is a lot of anxiety for our educators right now.
Cheryl, it's when you say a lot of anxiety, I try to follow like everyone else. School systems are making these individual decisions, and they're not easy decisions. So walk us through. I'm hoping that MSEA has had a seat at the table. I'm trying to put myself in the place of a teacher who's trying to decide what they can and can't do. So from your members' perspective, walk us through what is happening in the mind of a teacher right now.
Well, first of all, our educators, all of them, they rose to the occasion in the spring in what we consider crisis learning, getting meals out, making sure technology was distributed, trying to get virtual learning to parents and students so that some education could take place. That was during a crisis time when we all left. But as soon as schools were declared closed, the actual physical plant being closed for the year, we advocated for our educators to have a seat at the table in those local decision-making bodies, to immediately start talking to superintendents and boards of education so that educators and all of them, bus drivers, teachers, parents could all have something to contribute to the conversation and be part of the decision-making process. And as that's gone on, we've had to look at health and safety and call in experts to say what's going to happen with this pandemic. We've also been dealing with social uprising after the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery. That's created a lot of anxiety and some goals that we have to do schooling differently so it addresses our Black and brown students. And then even if we go into a hybrid approach, which many people have been talking about with some in-person learning and some virtual learning, we have to get that right in circumstances where we don't have additional funding. Our schools are already inadequately funded. So all of these things are going on in people's minds and looking at, well, how do we disinfect our buildings? How do we get kids on a bus? How are we going to feed them? How are they going to pass each other in the hallway? Many of our educators are in high risk with underlying health conditions or of ages to do that. So all of this has been going into their minds and thought process. And then you got to look at child care. So parents want to get back to work. Our educators do want to get back to work and be in schools, but it has to be safe. So, Dawn, there's a lot of things that you and I have been in education for a while, but as you said, we've never had to contemplate all of this at one time.
So when you do that, Cheryl, let's just dive right into it then. Does MSEA have a preference? What are you communicating to the state superintendent? And what should school look like the first week of September?
So MSEA, we have been working with and listening to our educators. We haven't had the seat at the table as much at the state level as we would like to have. But they really gave them the decision back to the district. And so that's where we've been involved. And after listening to what's happening in other states, you see Florida spiking. You see summer camps in other states closing down. University of Texas shut down their football program because students started getting COVID-19. And so when we started to hear all of that, and then the HEROES Act got stuck in the Senate and Washington, D.C., and it's still stuck there. And Governor Hogan put up $300 million in cuts to the Board of Public Works and to the legislature. So when all of that converged, we came out with a position with the Maryland PTA and the Baltimore Teachers Union and said, we need to start virtually in the fall. The plans that were being laid out just didn't have enough of the safety precautions and materials put in place. So we came out last week and said we want schools to start out virtually, and let's get that right. We had in Baltimore County, they estimate 3,500 students who didn't ever check in after March 13th. So they never got the education that was being offered and that they needed to stay up to date and get academic success. So we have to make sure no students are left without learning to get this virtual part right. So we think it's the safe way to start. Get it right. Let's get the one-to-one devices for our students. Let's make sure everybody learns whatever platforms that we're using. And then maybe if the safety precautions and the funding to make sure our schools are safe, then maybe we can start a hybrid approach either in the fall or in the winter. But there's so much uncertainty with what's happening with this virus. As we see, anytime a place reopens, even here in Maryland, cases are on the rise.
Well, I think the hardest part navigating all of this is there's no sort of written rules, right? My old sports days, it reminds me when Roger Goodell was trying to hand out the, suspensions. Like, what we did yesterday doesn't matter today. The rules from last month might not be the rules. And there really was no playbook for any of this, right? And certainly over the last 5 months, all of you, all of us have been thinking about it on a daily basis, but there still is no sort of guideline to say this is when we can send them back, this is when we can't. And I would think that, and Don, please jump in here, if you're running the county, if you're running a municipality, I would look to the doctors, I would look to the epidemiologist, I would look to science. I don't know that we're doing a whole lot of looking to science right now on this. We're looking to government, aren't we?
Well, I think our local leaders have done a really good job, and Cheryl can certainly weigh in on this as well, but I think they've done, all across the nation, for the most part. Now, there are governors who are exceptions who have not been on top of it and who, for whatever reason, have I guess for out of fear for offending the president, have chosen not to stand with doctors. But it seems to me that local county executives and mayors and governors who have let science lead the way have been the most effective. And I think that's, you know, as you look at the decisions that school systems are starting to make, they do appear to be driven by science. One of my questions for Cheryl is, Cheryl, I don't know that MSEA has done any of this kind of analysis. I hate to put you on the spot, but I will. But one of the things that I hear as I get around and talk to educators is they've got a fear of what they'll call this sort of potential crisis that people aren't aware of. And what they're alluding to is there's a sense that there are a lot of teachers, and again, you and I were there, we know how this works, who are in their 26th, 27th, 28th year. They can go for 30, but they may be in a position where financially they could actually retire, and they're trying to decide whether or not the risk is worth coming back. First of all, do you hear any of that from teachers? And can you give us a sense of how many teachers might have that kind of experience?
Dawn, we are hearing from educators who are making a decision between their health and their career. We even hear people, our educators, more and more writing out their wills because they're just so fearful of going in, and whether it's their health, their family's health, or they're taking care of parents, there is a lot of concern. As of last October, the October data for the state of Maryland, we have 2,500 teachers out of 62,000, which is around 4%, that have over 30 years. So
wow.
We could lose 2,500 teachers. We have about the same amount. It goes up to about 2,700 that are in that 26 to 30 years. So you're talking about 5,000 teachers who have over 25 years of experience who could leave. The other part of this, though, are the younger teachers who, you know, there's just so much uncertainty for them. Even our pregnant mothers, they're saying that this could be harmful to the fetus. We turn over 47% of our teaching staff in 3 years.
Wow.
And what does that mean?
So we have a turnover.
Numbers,
so
numbers,
that
guys.
Just means, does that mean that people leave the industry or leave Maryland or leave their county? What does that mean?
Well, they're leaving the state of Maryland. Many are leaving the industry, A, because of pay, workload, lack of respect, lack of autonomy, meaning I can do what I need to do for the students in my class without somebody telling me that I have to be on this page, on this date. The overemphasis of testing that has now come into education is a deterrent. So we have a teacher shortage in this country. So people are not going into college to become teachers. We've already, many of our big systems this current year have had substitutes, long-term substitutes, filling core content subjects, all subjects, chemistry, math, you know, the languages. So all of those were facing shortages. 47% of our new educators that come in, they leave after 3 years. They go to college and they say, wow, this is way too much for one person to take on. The workload has become daunting. And Dawn, I'm way more than when we were there in education. We're hearing that the workload and the demands. And then you have another set that says, I can leave. I can go out. And they're making those decisions. We heard from a lot of people that are saying, I have to weigh this of what I'm going to do, whether it's my life in jeopardy and or what am I going to do for my family?
Well,
so those are big numbers.
I know. It's more than anecdotal, Cheryl, and I think it's so important to have you talk about it, because I know I heard from a principal recently who said that a really good teacher, one of her really good elementary teachers, who didn't have quite 30 in, but was close, said, look, I still enjoy it, but I've got to weigh all those things you just talked about. And I think for my family and my mental health and my physical health, I think I'm just going to go ahead and retire. When I was doing the math real quick in my head, it was well over 5,000 teachers then that within 26 or more than 30 years, I mean, if we were to lose half of that, we don't have the capacity in this state, Cheryl, and correct me if I'm wrong, to just on the drop of a hat replace 2,500 teachers.
We do not have the capacity, especially when we're faced with vacancies. And Don, that's just teachers. The number grows when we look at administrators because they tend to be later in their career because they've done the teaching and they've earned the master's or doctorates to become administrator. So it's even greater. We have 157 principals who are over 30 years experience. So just imagine if 157 principals just left. That would leave
that's statewide data, Cheryl.
That's statewide data. Mm-hmm.
That's a big number.
That's statewide data. It is a big number. And, you know, it was interesting when we started into this pandemic, there was such high regard for our teachers because people then were teaching their own students and realizing how difficult it was. And now within a month or so, people are like, oh, well, they just need to go back in. Well, we have to look at the health of everybody. And then, Dawn, if we take that to bus drivers, it's just anecdotal data right now, but many of our bus drivers are even older. And so they're the first people who are going to experience our students as they get on buses. And how many of them are going to come back? And again, we're already faced with a shortage of bus drivers. So every key component has shortages, it has fear and anxiety. I think it helped some of our educators to know that we were going to start off virtually, kind of ease a little bit of anxiety. I've seen that when I'm looking at social media and hearing from educators, they're like, okay, I can get this right, but the fear is still looming out there of what happens if, you know, as the president is threatening to hold back federal funds, if districts don't open all in person, that'll even be less money to get the resources and the health and safety equipment that we would need to open schools.
Well, Cheryl, how frustrating is it for you? And we can't beat around this question. We have to come right to it. How frustrating is it to you and your colleagues and teachers to have someone like Betsy DeVos, who really just appears to approach this job as a hobby and not really take it seriously and have no serious educational background? How frustrating is that for you?
It's demoralizing. As a teacher myself, it's extremely demoralizing that somebody does not value us, value our input, or even value public education. When we get compared to other countries and people say how well Finland is doing or Singapore, well, education is highly revered in these countries, and we have a Secretary of Education who puts us down and hinders everything that we try to do at every turn. And we have to understand what her goals are, and she states them clearly. She really wants to dismantle public education in this country. It's the equalizer. It's what we have to do, especially for our impoverished students, and to give everybody a chance. And she has said recently, well, we should just take the money and let parents go use that money to a private schools or private charters. So her intentions as the Secretary of Education is to destroy public education. So it's demoralizing, and it really is, I would think it should be illegal for her to be the Secretary of Education when she wants to dismantle public education.
Bravo. She is Cheryl Boast. She's joining us here on behalf of the Maryland State Educators Association. Tell everybody what MSEA is, just so we have a better understanding of that for our audience, Cheryl.
Sure. We're the largest union in the state of Maryland, and we represent educators across the state, except for Baltimore City, which is a sister organization of ours. But we represent and work on behalf of students in every jurisdiction outside of Baltimore City, representing bus drivers, custodians, teachers, psychologists, nurses, administrators, you name it. And we're always advocating for public education here in the state of Maryland.
Don, put your principal's hat back on from back in the day and tell me from a principal's chair right now what this looks like from bringing all of this together. If you're principal of a school with 1,000 kids, how many of them have Wi-Fi? How many don't? What becomes the challenge at the local level for Colgate Elementary that's being rebuilt right now, by the way, which looks lovely? Thank you, Johnny O. My wife told me that. My wife drove by the school. She said, man, it's looking great. You should see it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful school. Very, very proud of the legacy of my my former boss, Kevin Kamenetz, and his commitment. And Jim Smith. Jim Smith really led the fight early on along with Martin O'Malley when Governor O'Malley was governor to increase funding for school construction. And we'll get into that issue with Cheryl a little bit as well when we talk about Kerwin and school construction. But Nestor, to your question, I think about that often, what I would do as a principal. And
your daughter is one, by the way. I want to point that out, right?
Yeah,
so she does think about it.
Yeah, she's probably far better than I ever was. But what I would do is I would bring key members of my staff in. I would be meeting regularly with my teachers and taking my lead from them in terms of what they needed to be supported to make this happen, and also communicating with parents, having a real work group, say, to moms and dads, what are you going to need, particularly if we go in this virtual world? So I think it's about trying to put all of the pieces together and include everyone at the table so that teachers feel valued, so that, you know, the example that I always use, Nestor and Cheryl, is it's, and teachers are no different than anyone else. They're actually no different than the student who's trying to learn Algebra 1 and be frustrated by it. We all want to be successful. Now, I use the example all the time. I am the worst Harry homeowner guy that there is on the place, on the planet. Somewhere along the way, nobody taught me those skills. So I'm not great at hanging curtain rods and fixing door nails and fixing leaky faucets. And as a matter of fact, if I'm trying to hang a curtain rod that's a little complex or something, and I mess it up and put a hole in the wall, I probably end up throwing the drill across the room because I'm so frustrated. And I think we have to think of it that way with our teachers, is as Cheryl said early on, they're trying to do something that they've never had to do before. We have to respect them and their professionalism and do everything we can to help them be successful in this new world order so that they're not throwing the drill across the room. And that's the way I would try to think.
And I guess in many cases as well, I think about my elementary school education. I just think about small children. Meeting your teacher, right? Like literally, if you're going from the first grade into the second grade or second grade into third grade, just knowing your teacher. And Don, you would speak to this for your friend who was Julie Janda, who was my first grade teacher. The fact that, you know, I did spend 9 months every day, that there really is something very foundational about that missing part that I can't get my head around as a grown-up.
Nestor, I am sure, and we'll ask Cheryl to jump in here, I am sure that there are just hundreds of Ms. Bost's former students running around that she still remains in contact with, that are still fond of her. Recreating that bond, Cheryl, talk about it. That's what Nestor's alluding to.
It is, and it is something that our educators miss every day. I have two nieces who are teachers in Pennsylvania, and they cried when their kids left, and they don't know what to do when they don't get to see the faces and get to know the personalities of the students coming into their class in the coming year. And it's going to be different. We're going to have to get creative in how we do that, especially for our young kids. I was thinking the other day, maybe we could put hula hoops in the middle of the field from first grade to come in and meet their teachers, but everybody socially distanced. Everybody has to be in a hula hoop. So we're away from each other. But
man, you were a teacher, man. You're coming up with stuff, right?
There's a teacher idea for you, Nestor.
Man, that's rubber bands and you know, spit and glue and paper, putting it all together. I like it, you know?
It is a teacher moment because I thought, you know, how are we going to use our bus drivers? Well, we could set up bookmobiles to go into communities, art mobiles so they could give art supplies. We could really become creative in how we do this. But I agree with Dawn. It's going to be school by school on how they get these resources, they get the one-to-one devices. Maybe some of our school buses have to serve as hotspots in some communities. Because what's going to be different is what an elementary school looks like. You talked about Colgate Elementary versus Perry Hall High School, who has over 2,000 students. You know what those hallways look like. We can't do that as we always have when we bring them back in person at some point. We're going to have to figure out something different. But it's going to take talking, and in the high school, I think the students have to be part of that conversation. And another concern that comes up to our teachers is what happens to the parents and students who don't believe in this COVID-19 and don't believe in wearing masks? And what about when we come back in person?
Those are exactly the people who need to be educated.
And when the history of this is written, of the many sins of this president, mm-hmm. his fermenting of this idea that a lot of this was a hoax and that you didn't have to wear a mask, that's actually going to be the most criminal part of this activity. Because as you said, Cheryl, there are going to be hundreds of families and kids who don't believe. And all of a sudden, coming back to school and interacting with others is going to be a political exercise. And our principals and our teachers aren't trained to mediate political disputes. It's just not what they're supposed to be doing.
Absolutely. We see it right now in retail and grocery stores where people are getting beaten up. One person was shot and killed for trying to enforce wearing a mask. That shouldn't be part of what we have to do. It started at the top on that.
Well, we could talk about that one all night. Cheryl Post is here from the Maryland State Educators Association, trying to get people ready. So what are you telling your people? What is the, at some point, I mean, Don's taught me this about leadership. At some point, there has to be a message, right? I mean, even if the message is no message, there's a message, right? What is the message right now? And to your point, trying to get everyone on the same page, that's just not going to happen in America right now. But trying to get everybody on the safe page, that's got to happen. That has to happen.
It has to happen. And we again, with the Maryland PTA and BTU, are calling for all schools to start out virtually and take the time and use the focus and resources to get that right, making sure each student has access to a tablet or some type of technology. We have to work with our cable carriers to get our connectivity improved. Again, maybe we use some of our school buses as hotspots. And then we have to educate our parents and our teachers and our students and all of our support professionals on whatever platforms we're going to use, because our parents are going to be our partners in this educational process. So they have to know the technology. We have to get this right to even start in person. But what happens if we even started in person, pick a month, October or January, and all of a sudden our numbers rise and we have to go back to isolation, everything shut down? We want to be able to continue that learning and not go into a crisis learning, series. So it's important that we do virtual learning. We do it right for all students. We have to fix the inequities. Too many of our Black and Brown students and too many of our students living in poverty just were not connected and getting an education. So, Nestor, I think that's what has to happen first. And then we have to look at the federal, state, and local governments to fund that. You know, we pulled out all the stops. We made the convention center into a hospital. We made hotels into hospitals. We brought test kits from South Korea. I know that's another story. But
that's next week when Larry calls in. He's called everybody else this week. Why not us?
Right. But we did all of that when it was a health crisis, and it was the right thing to do. This is our next area of crisis, is trying to get our schools better equipped and ready to deliver instruction. And all we're hearing are educational cuts, funding cuts, $300 million from Governor Hogan, withholding funds from the federal government. Really, education has to become a top priority if we want our kids back learning and eventually, hopefully, in person.
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself. There you go, Don, right?
Yeah, speaking of funding, anyone who's listened to Baltimore Positive knows how passionate we've been about Kerwin. We were very excited when it passed both houses of the General Assembly. And then, lo and behold, the governor vetoes Kerwin, which also then involves eliminating the school construction budget that was going to make a difference in counties across the state. Talk to us about next steps from your perspective about Kerwin. We've certainly spoken with Senate President Ferguson. We spoke recently with Delegate Brooke Learney. forward not to do it. Talk to us about MSEA's role and how we're going to save Kerwin.
Well, it was a big blow to our students and really our entire state when Governor Hogan chose to veto the blueprint for Maryland's future, which is really the long-term plan out of this crisis. And it, as you said, it also killed the Built to Learn Act, which would have put more money into our infrastructure. That would have been jobs and to get us out of the economic crisis that we're in. So we are calling on everybody, parents, supporters, educators, to continue to email your delegates and senators, asking them to override the governor's veto as soon as they go back into session. Again, it's the long-term fix for education and to address the inequities that we have in our public schools. We also need to stop the governor from making any cuts through the Board of Public Works. We were able to hold off on the $100 million that he was asking the comptroller and treasurer to join him in making cuts to the current budget. And we also have to write the federal level and say, we need some support here in our states. Don't put strings to it. Don't put caveats of whether you open or don't open. Give the schools the money that they need so that we could do the right thing and educate our students in our public schools. But unfortunately, Governor Hogan, since the beginning, has never been a friend of public education. He started a voucher program. He touts that he's put more funding into education than any other governor, but it's all written by law and inflationary numbers. He's not giving additional money to education. So we need to call him on that those facts, and we need to ask him and require him to do the blueprint, and that'll be through an override of his veto. It's critically important. Our kids deserve the promise of education that this Constitution calls for, and they can no longer wait for that investment and for us to get things right.
Well, Cheryl, it's always great. Go ahead, Don, up to you.
I was going to say, before we let Cheryl get out of here, Nestor, as much as it breaks your and my heart, we know that Ms. Bost bleeds the black and gold up there in Pittsburgh and is hoping that Big Ben is on the mend. What's your gut tell you, Cheryl? We're going to have football?
I'm worried we're not going to have football. I'm a season ticket holder for the first time for the Steelers, and I might not have a season. But here's the thing, Don.
Unless you'll watch them lose this year, I think.
No. It bothers me, though, that our athletes can get tested every day and get immediate results and everything taken care of, and we can't get that here with our schools. So if anything has to happen first, it's the materials and resources for our schools before the pro athletes.
Perfectly said. Well stated.
We'll be having that argument all month long here at WNST as I'm trying to wonder what they're doing, too, in regard to sports and schools and all of us being led back in when the headlines are screaming the pandemic is far from over here. Cheryl, we appreciate the visit. If anybody wants to find you, find more information, give them the primer on where they can learn more about these causes. And I'm sure there might even be some teachers out there that are not as connected as they should be informationally, right?
Absolutely. We have a robust website, MarylandEducators.org. If you go there and you do /coronavirus, you get all kinds of information about what we're doing during the coronavirus. You can also go to our resources and find what we're trying to do to eradicate institutional racism. Lots of topics. We want the state to get a waiver for our testing that we might have to do this spring. So that's on there, MarylandEducators.org. You can reach me, and you can get lots of information.
Well, on behalf of my one-time high school guidance counselor at Dundalk High School, Don Moeller, we appreciate you you coming by and talking about all these really, really important issues. And I think with the pandemic and with education, and I mean, it does bring things like Kerwin to the forefront to sort of color it out for people as to what the future looks like if we don't fix these issues and get our children educated. So, Cheryl, hats off to you for all things other than being a Steelers fan. We still might have some football. So there'll come a week where I'll give you a hard time or two. How about that?
any time, we're happy to go toe-to-toe on football. And I just want to reach out and say thank you to all of our educators. They've stepped up. They continue to do so. And we thank them for everything that they do.
We do indeed.
True heroes.
Appreciate it. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, I am Nestor Aparicio. You can find us out on Facebook and Twitter and building a bigger, better Baltimore Positive at WNST.net for you. We are WNST.net, AM 1570. Keeping calm, staying local, mixing a little baseball and football in, and a lot of Baltimore Positive.